This is Ocean Robbins, and I am so excited to welcome you to Day 7 in the Food Revolution Summit. Today's topic is food politics. Don't let McDonald's, Coca-Cola, or Monsanto control your menu or your country. In a few minutes, we're going to be on the line with pediatric endocrinologist Dr. Robert Lustig. At the top of the next hour, we'll hear from food politics author Dr. Marion Nessel. And an hour after that, we'll hear from Center for Science and the Public Interest co-founder and director, Dr. Michael Jacobson. Here we go. Welcome to the Food Revolution Summit, where we explore how you can heal your body and your world with food. This is Ocean Robbins, and I am joined by my dad and colleague, John Robbins, in welcoming our guest, Dr. Robert Lustig. Dr. Robert Lustig is professor of pediatrics in the Division of Endocrinology at the University of California, San Francisco, and the director of weight assessment for UCSF's Teen and Child Health Program. He is author of Fat Chance, Beating the Odds Against Sugar, Processed Food, Obesity, and Disease. More than 4 million people have watched Dr. Lustig's provocative YouTube video, Sugar, the Bitter Truth. He's become a globally recognized leader in the quest to understand the scientific underpinnings of sugar addiction. Dr. Lustig's work is blowing the cover on sugar's profoundly under-recognized role in driving many of the health crises of our times. He has authored 85 peer-reviewed articles and trained dozens of other health professionals. Dr. Lustig is featured in the new and award-winning Katie Couric-narrated feature film, Fed Up. So now, Dr. Lustig, my dad and I are so grateful to have this time with you. And now for the interview, I'm going to hand it over to my dad, John Robbins.
Thank you, Ocean, and welcome, Dr. Lustig. It is a pleasure to have you with us today.
It's my pleasure.
I want to start where I'm sure all of the people who speak with you nowadays probably do, which is your lecture video, Sugar the Bitter Truth, has become such a sensation on YouTube. The views now are approaching 5 million. You are certainly charming and witty and fun to watch, but I don't think that alone can explain the extraordinary interest in your message. I think what may explain partly the phenomenal response is that you are providing compelling evidence for a rather difficult to swallow piece of news, which is that sugar is actually a poison. I mean, I don't hear you saying that sugar is acutely toxic, like a poison such as cyanide, but I hear you saying that it is chronically toxic, which would put it in the same category as cigarettes, something that toxicity develops over a longer period of time.
Exactly.
If I'm hearing you correctly, you're saying that our excessive consumption of sugar is causing one of the great health epidemics of our time. Am I hearing you correctly, and can you explain?
Sure. Let me be very honest with you and with the audience. It's not just about sugar. It's about our processed food epidemic. Processed food has several things wrong with it. Let me sum them up for you. There are 3 things too little and 5 things too much. The 3 things that are too little fiber, too little micronutrients, too little omega-3 fatty acids. And now the 5 things too much. Too much branched chain amino acids, that's leucine, isoleucine, and valine, which you find in corn-fed beef, chicken, and fish. Too much trans fats. Too much omega-6 fatty acids found in seed oils. Too much alcohol. And finally, the big kahuna, too much sugar. All of these are contributing to our dietary debacle. But of those 8, sugar is the one that the food industry specifically uses for its own purposes, not for ours, to get us to purchase more. In addition, sugar is the one that kids are exposed to in particular. And we are seeing diseases of the aged now occurring in 10-year-olds. So this is where the action has to be. Sugar is the fulcrum by which the processed food arguments can be advanced in Washington. And that's why it's so important to pay attention to it.
the food industry now employs a whole new breed of mad food scientists that they call craveability experts.
Yes.
Their job is to invent addictive, hyper-palatable, processed and junk foods to ensure that their employers get the biggest market share, what the industry insiders call stomach share. If it's true that sugar and highly processed foods affect our brains in ways that drive addiction, then it seems to me that we must at some point face the moral question inherent in feeding our kids, and feeding our adults for that matter as well, substances that probably kill more people than smoking, alcohol, cocaine, and heroin combined.
That's right. The bottom line is that a little sugar is okay and had been for generations, really, you know, for hundreds of years. But a lot is not. We have a limited capacity to metabolize the stuff. In the same way we have a limited capacity to metabolize all poisons. The dose determines the poison. It just so happens that for sugar, we can metabolize a little bit more than for other poisons, where we would get sick at a much lower level. So, you know, the dose has to be relatively high to see those effects. But the fact is, we now are way overdosed by about double to triple. And that is being done by the food industry specifically for the reasons you just mentioned, because they have learned that when they put the right amount of sugar in any given foodstuff, we go hog wild. And there are now neuroimaging studies that demonstrate this phenomenon. The problem is that hog wild, which they call the bliss point, is where the dopamine, the pleasure neurotransmitter in our brain, is most active. The problem with dopamine is not that it causes pleasure, that's fine, but the problem with dopamine is that it downregulates its own receptor. That means that the next time you get a hit, you need a larger dose in order to accomplish the same effect. And what happens is you end up in a vicious cycle of more and more in order to get less and less, until finally you need an enormous amount to get almost nothing. And that's the phenomenon of tolerance. And that has now clearly been shown, not just in animals, but in humans. Tolerance is one half of the phenomenon of addiction. So if the food industry has basically adopted this practice of getting us to purchase more for their own purposes, yet in the process are hurting us, the question is, can that stand? And my view is, no, that cannot stand. It's fine for the food industry to sell food. It's not fine for the food industry to sell food that hurts us.
When you talk about tolerance, I think of that phenomenon I usually associated in my mind with heroin and other highly addictive drugs. I saw just very recently a new study published online in the journal Archives of Disease and Childhood, which indicates that obese children and adolescents, compared to their lean counterparts, have less sensitive taste buds. The study couldn't determine if obesity is the result of innately less sensitive taste buds, or if the foods that fuel obesity deaden taste buds, perhaps by bathing them all day long in sugar, salt, and maybe even food chemicals such as monosodium glutamate. But it seems to me that if you bathe your taste buds all day long, they're going to become insensitive.
That's right. The data at this point only show correlation, not causation, so we can't answer that question. But there is a very clear ability of people who go off sugar to basically redevelop tastes for other foods. And we see it in our clinic all the time, and there's data that supports that. So my guess is that this is something that is not immediately innate. That, you know, it's not that individuals who are obese have a more deadened palate. There is some data that suggests that some people who gain weight might actually have a problem in dopamine signal transduction in the brain. You know, that the dopamine receptor is chronically and genetically altered so that they need more in order to accomplish the same effect. But that's a relatively uncommon problem. The bottom line is, we need to de-sweeten our lives. We need to get this stuff out of our diet. We need to be able to make choices as to whether to put it in our diet rather than the food industry deciding it for us. And that's what's going on right now.
It is. It's going on at a level that most people don't realize. I mean, if you go into a supermarket or a grocery store, pretty much anywhere in the country, and you pick up an item that has a label, a food label, the odds are very high that it will have some form of added sugar, most likely high fructose corn syrup, but there are many others as well. Now, there are probably hundreds of thousands of food items for sale in this country. What percentage of them have added sugar?
According to the most recent data, 77% of the 600,000 food items available in America are laced with added sugar. That's a tremendous amount. And what it means is that people can't find products that would actually be healthy because they've all been basically adulterated. When you reach market saturation, as the food industry currently has for sugar, it actually limits choice. Everyone says, you know, everybody should be able to choose what they put in their mouths, and I agree with that. The problem is you've already been told what to put in your mouth by the food industry because of this change that's occurred over the past 40 years as processed foods and sweets have basically taken over the entire grocery store. That is not choice.
As processed food has taken over the grocery store and our taste buds and our health, there's been a tremendous, obviously, increase in obesity and diabetes and other related disorders. If I'm hearing you properly, we've known for some time that sugar provides empty calories and as such contributes to obesity and diabetes. But I hear you going further, saying that its effect on us is more insidious, that there's something about the way we metabolize sugar at the levels we now consume it that causes fat to accumulate in our livers, which in turn leads to insulin resistance and metabolic syndrome and then to diabetes and obesity and possibly even to heart disease and maybe even cancer. This is a whole cascade of ill that sugar produces. How does that happen?
Well, Mr. Robbins, you said the mantra that the food industry would like us to believe, and that is that sugar is empty calories. That is, the only thing that sugar provides us with are extra calories, and they're mantra is, well, you can get your extra calories wherever you choose. You can get it from carrots, you can get it from cheesecake, you can get it from Coca-Cola, because a calorie is a calorie. And it doesn't matter where those calories come from. Therefore, why would you pick on any individual foodstuff or any individual food additive, for that matter, like sugar? If sugar were just empty calories, they would be exactly right. The problem is that's not what the data show. The science says something completely different. Because of the way sugar is metabolized, the molecule in sugar called fructose, the sweet molecule in sugar, is metabolized by the liver completely different from the other molecule in sugar called glucose, which is the energy of life. That molecule fructose, because of the way it's metabolized, overloads your liver, causes liver fat accumulation, which then leads to all the chronic metabolic diseases that we know about, type 2 diabetes, heart disease, hypertension, and likely, we're not sure of this yet, cancer and dementia as well. Our group has shown that sugar is the proximate cause of diabetes worldwide, exclusive of its effects on obesity, exclusive of calories, and exclusive of physical activity. And this is going on all over the world now, not just here in America, because of the increase in sugar consumption worldwide. Others have shown that the percent of calories as sugar predicts heart disease deaths nationwide over a decade. Other people have shown that the amount of sugar in fast food predicts obesity rates over the decade. So these are all predictive studies and causative studies that say that sugar is very specifically different from other calories. And if you believe that, which I do because I've generated the data and I've seen the other data, then sugar becomes a uniquely problematic foodstuff and needs some form of intervention. It's not okay for the food industry to keep doing what they're doing and expect us to somehow be able to sift through those 600,000 food items to be able to take care of ourselves. They have a responsibility. They have a corporate responsibility to our health, which they are basically violating.
You're saying that the food industry is violating our health by adding so much sugar to the food products they sell to us. And far from providing us with freedom of choice, you're saying the food industry is actually diminishing our choices, because such a huge percentage of the food products they sell to us are highly processed and contain so much added sugar. Is there also economic harm involved?
The fact of the matter is, we are losing more money out of society than the food industry is making. This is breaking the healthcare bank. The reason why we are now in such a dire healthcare strait is because of chronic metabolic disease. Everybody pins it on the obesity epidemic, but that is not true, because obesity itself doesn't cost very much. It's the diseases that travel with obesity that cost the money. And when you do the math, our government is losing more money than they are making on food industry tariffs. So it's one of the reasons why we have such a huge budget deficit in this country. So it's not just a question of health for all. It's a question of economic justice for all. And the fact is, right now, we are losing that battle.
This is the first generation of American children expected to live shorter lives than their parents. Childhood obesity has nearly tripled in children and quadrupled in adolescents in the past 30 years. You and your wife have two children, I think.
Yeah.
Does your wife bake cookies and birthday cakes for your kids? Do you let them eat sweets?
Yeah. My wife is Norwegian. I can't stop her. she bakes when she's mad. she uses it as therapy. I can't stop her. I've tried. but she has experimented herself. She reduces the amount of sugar in the recipe by one-third. And the cakes and the cookies actually come out tasting better, because you can taste the chocolate, you can taste the nuts, you can taste the oatmeal. You can actually improve the flavor of foods. Now, one of the questions is, why is there so much sugar in all of our foods? And the answer is because the food industry has learned that it's a preservative. It changes the water activity so that it's much less likely that foods will go stale. In addition, because high fructose corn syrup is miscible in food because it's already in liquid, it doesn't settle out, so that they can actually add more to be able to let them live on the shelf longer. It's a matter of depreciation. It works for the food industry. The problem is, it doesn't work for your health.
We in this culture often look at obesity as though it were a character flaw. The person is assumed to be lazy or self-indulgent, unable or unwilling to exercise enough willpower to control their appetite. It is true that overeating and being sedentary will generally make a person gain weight, but that can't fully explain the sudden explosion in obesity that we're seeing today. I know you take care of children and babies. Are you seeing obesity in babies, and what's your view of our tendency to blame overweight people for their predicament?
You know, everybody wants this to be the individual's fault. You know, personal responsibility. You get to choose what you put in your mouth. But I've already shown you, you don't get to choose what you put in your mouth when, you know, the market is saturated. In addition, there's no knowledge, because on the food label, they list total sugars, not added sugars, and they don't tell you what the limit is. So how can you expect people to be able to make rational choices when they don't know how much is too much? They don't have access. They don't have the knowledge. They can't afford to eat properly, because real food is so expensive. The bottom line is, personal responsibility breaks down when you're talking about the obese six-month-old. You know, they don't diet and exercise. Personal responsibility breaks down when we're talking about obese newborns. So, four studies, Russia, South Africa, Israel, the United States. Over the past 25 years, birth weight is up 500 grams, or the pound, in every one of those countries over those 25 years. And when you do the DEXA scanning to determine body composition on those babies, on those newborns, it turns out it's all fat. So we're basically giving birth to obese newborns. Now, how do you explain obesity in newborns if you're trying to invoke personal responsibility? So this concept of you get to choose is completely misguided, and actually used by the food industry to obviate the negative effects of their foodstuffs. I would also bring to light that this concept of personal responsibility, while people like to think that this is an issue that's been around since the American Revolution, you know, and signifies American freedom, is actually a concoction of the tobacco industry in the 1960s. They were losing the war on health. So what they did was they put all their eggs in the basket of personal responsibility and said, well, you get to choose whether you smoke or not. Well, in fact, you don't get to choose whether you smoke or not when you're addicted. You only get to choose whether you ever have that first cigarette. And then, after that, they've got you. So the bottom line is, this is not a matter of choice. This is not a matter of personal responsibility. This is not a behavior. This is an exposure, just like every other public health crisis that we've had in this country. And we need to basically wake up and smell the non-sweetened coffee, because this is a problem that is not going to go away until our environment is fixed and our environment becomes safe again.
You mentioned tobacco and how the tobacco industry has used the concept of personal responsibility to justify selling a highly addictive and deadly product. It seems to me that big tobacco and big food are playing by the same playbook and using similar strategies. In fact, they're sometimes the very same companies. Philip Morris Kraft, for example, changed its name to Altria to hide the fact that a tobacco company now owns one of the largest food companies in the world. I know you've worked in the United Kingdom. What's being done there to counter the food industry's proclivity to add so much sugar to just about every food product?
Well, in the UK, there is a political action group that has been formed by academics, you know, by physicians and scientists who do not have any bias. The group is called Action on Sugar, and their goal is to pressure the UK government to put pressure on the food industry in the UK to start reducing by weaning the amount of added sugar in given foodstuffs across the board, across companies, in so that there's no competitive disadvantage for any given company, in order to reduce the total amount of sugar within the food supply. They did this for salt 10 years ago with great success, and they did it without telling the British people that they were doing it. And they were able to get the salt consumption down, and they believe they can do the same with sugar.
It would be great if we could accomplish something similar in the United States. I know there have been similar attempts to reduce the amount of salt in the U.S. food supply, but I don't think they've been nearly as successful.
In America, the Institute of Medicine and the FDA announced in 2010 that they were going to do the same thing to try to get salt down in the food supply by working with companies, and the companies have fought back tooth and nail, and nothing has been done regarding our salt consumption. So what we've got is we've got a recalcitrant food industry who refuses to alter their products to improve American health. And we're going to require either legislation and or litigation in order to basically bring the food industry to heel. And that is what our nonprofit, the Institute for Responsible Nutrition, is dedicated to doing, is to improve the global food supply, particularly here in America, by advocating for policy change that will ultimately impact Americans' health in a positive way.
That sounds like a very positive step, but there are groups with other agendas. I'm thinking in particular of the National Soft Drink Association. Their scientists will often claim that there is no association between sugar consumption and obesity. They say this repeatedly, and they say it despite compelling evidence otherwise. What goes through your mind when you hear them make those kinds of claims?
Well, it's very interesting that you bring that up. A paper just came out in the journal Plus One 2 months ago. The first author is Rez Bastrolo. And what they did was they looked at the 18 studies, the 18 meta-analyses that are out regarding sugar beverage consumption and obesity. And there were 6 that were funded by the food industry, and there were 12 that were independently funded. And it turned out of the 6 that were funded by the food industry, 5 of the 6 showed no effect of sugar beverages on obesity. But when you looked at the 12 that were independently funded, 10 out of the 12 showed a clear and significant effect of sugar beverages on obesity. In other words, the food industry puts out data that coincides with their agenda. And it is not okay for the food industry to be doing that. That's another thing that has to be fought. I am about the unbiased science. I am not beholden to any food industry or organization. Basically, It's about the science. I came here to this issue because of the science, not because I had a preconceived agenda. I'm a pediatric endocrinologist. I've been doing this for 33 years. I entered the obesity field about 18 years ago because I was taking care of kids with brain tumors who became massively obese. I didn't come to obesity, you know, with an agenda. My job is to take care of obese kids and improve their weight and their lives. And the food industry, their agenda is the exact opposite. And it's time for the food industry to basically do the right thing. And they're only going to do the right thing if they're coerced into doing the right thing. That's our job.
Speaking of the science, I know we now have brain scans showing that stimulation of the receptors in the human tongue that detect the taste of sugar generates reward signals in the brain that are very similar to those produced by cocaine. Yeah. What is the science telling us about the addictive nature or potential of sugar?
Well, I just came from a meeting on food addiction with several neuroimagers who have done this work. The one I would call attention to is Dr. Eric Stice at the University of Oregon. He has a system where he does functional MRI in the brain, looking at that reward center, the nucleus accumbens, and the activity of it based on consumption of a milkshake where you can titrate the amount of fat and the amount of sugar to determine what's what. And it turns out that the fat in the milkshake stimulates areas of the somatosensory cortex, that is, mouthfeel. But the only thing that turned on the reward center was sugar. And when they got to a point of sugar saturation of that system, adding fat didn't change it. In other words, they're both important in terms of why you get the bliss point from a milkshake, but it's the sugar that's driving the reward. It's the sugar that's driving the dopamine. Therefore, it's the sugar that's driving the tolerance and addiction. So sugar's the bad guy in this story, and what we need to do is we need to reduce our consumption of it. But, of course, the food industry will do everything they can to obfuscate that message.
Some people understand that sugar is bad for them, and so in order to eat healthier, they drink diet soda. These are beverages, of course, that are sweetened with artificial sweeteners that are non-caloric. Is that a good idea?
Well, and I'll give you two reasons to be concerned about this. So there's something called pharmacokinetics, and there's something called pharmacodynamics. They're not the same. Pharmacokinetics is what your body does to a drug. Pharmacodynamics is what a drug does to your body. They're not the same. We have all the pharmacokinetics for all the diet sweeteners because the FDA demands that. Because pharmacokinetics tells you about acute toxicity, and that's the FDA's job, is to guard against acute toxicity, that you don't keel over and die from something. So we have all of the pharmacokinetics for all the diet sweeteners. But we don't have any of the pharmacodynamics because the FDA does not demand it. Because that tells you about chronic toxicity, and that's not in the FDA's purview. That's not even in the FDA's charter to worry about chronic toxicity. So the food industry says, well, gee, if the FDA is not going to ask for those studies, you know, those can't help our sales. They're expensive. They take a long time. We're not going to do them. And the National Institute of Health says, well, you know, that's the food industry's compound. We're not going to pay for it. So we got an FDA who doesn't ask for it, we got a food industry who won't do it, and we got an NIH who won't pay for it. No data. Now, second problem. You put something sweet on the tongue. Message goes to the brain, says sugar bolus is coming. Brain sends a message to the pancreas via the vagus nerve, says get ready to release the insulin. But then the sugar bolus never comes because it was a diet sweetener. What does the pancreas do? Does it say, oh man, I thought that sugar bolus was coming. I guess I'll just have to wait till tomorrow. Or does the pancreas say, you know, I got all these insulin vesicles stored up and ready to go. I'm going to go find some calories to work on. And so you overeat other calories instead. Which is it? You know, we still don't know that. But a paper came out last year, just around this time, from a group at Washington University, St. Louis, which looked at this question and showed that when you do an oral glucose tolerance test with a diet soda pretreatment, the amount of insulin released is 20% higher, even though you didn't take in any extra calories. That would suggest that your pancreas, your insulin, is being driven by the sweetness rather than just the sugar. And if that were the case, and we ultimately prove that that is the case, then diet sweeteners will not be the answer to our sugar dilemma.
I'm wanting to understand a little more clearly the relationship between the pancreas and insulin and fatty liver syndrome and the whole cascade of illnesses that stem from that.
Well, so the reason sugar is such a problem is because it's metabolized in the liver, that fructose is metabolized in the liver. When fructose overwhelms the ability of the liver to turn it into energy at the level of the mitochondria, which are the little energy-burning factories inside cells, the mitochondria have no choice but to take the excess and turn it into liver fat. And now that liver fat should get exported out as triglyceride. Problem is that some of the fat doesn't make it out of the liver, precipitates in the liver, forms lipid droplets, and now you've got non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. And America, 33% of Americans now have non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, considering this was a disease that didn't even exist in 1980. The fact that 33% of Americans now have it, this is the true epidemic. And many of those patients will go on to develop cirrhosis and ultimately either die of liver disease or require a liver transplant. So this concept that sugar is okay because it's just empty calories really is not borne out by what we have seen in terms of the rise of these chronic metabolic diseases that stem from that fatty liver that comes from sugar consumption, which then causes the pancreas to make extra insulin to make the liver do its job. And that raises insulin all over the body, and when your insulin's high, that number one drives all those diseases, and number two drives weight gain. So the obesity is a function of the insulin, and the insulin is a function of the liver fat, and the liver fat is a function of the sugar.
It seems to me that we really have to do something about this. It seems to me that sugar is meeting the same criteria that tobacco and alcohol meet, and we regulate them, and we certainly keep them out of the hands of children. If it's true that sugar has an equivalent or a similar potential for toxicity and abuse, and that obviously is having, as you've described, an immensely negative economic impact on society, shouldn't we be regulating sugar the way that we do tobacco and alcohol?
Well, you know, there are four criteria for societal intervention around a given substance: ubiquity, toxicity, abuse, and negative impact on society. Tobacco and alcohol clearly meet all four of those easily. Well, it turns out, when you look at the science, sugar meets all four criteria as well. So the question is, if sugar meets those criteria and sugar is costing society in a big way, shouldn't we be doing something to intervene? And, you know, by intervention, the short answer is regulation. And the answer is, I believe so. Obviously, we've got a long way to go. Congress is not exactly enamored with this idea. Plus, they take a lot of money from big sugar. So the bottom line is that the sugar lobby wields an extraordinarily powerful influence in Washington. And so the notion that somehow we're going to be able to federally regulate sugar consumption via a Congress that has already been bought off, 338 members of Congress take money from the American Legislative and Exchange Council, or ALEC, which is a front for the sugar and food industry. Bottom line is, it's going to be a long time before this Congress sees the ways of, you know, the science and does something about it. This is going to require advocacy at many levels and ultimately may require the courts.
When you say that sugar is not just a guilty pleasure and it's not just a source of empty calories, but it's a health disaster, you're going up against not just enormous industries with trillions of dollars at stake. You're also going up against the resistance each of us feels to giving up the highly sweetened foods we've come to enjoy and may have come to be addicted to.
Indeed, this is the big problem. You know, this was what happened with cigarettes. You know, the fact of the matter is there were a lot of people who liked their cigarettes. And, you know, cigarettes were glorified and, you know, popularized through standard, you know, culture in magazines, in, you know, commercials, in movies. You know, it was cool. Well, you know, The fact is, we demonized the tobacco industry. And over 30 years, tobacco went from fashionable to filthy habit because of a cultural tectonic shift that occurred. And that has occurred several times in our recent experience here in America. Three things that I can think of where we've had a cultural tectonic shift. The first is cigarettes. The second is condoms in bathrooms. And the third is seatbelts. These are three things that in 1980 were anathema, and now they're just standard practice. And it all occurred because of a public health and education campaign that occurred, you know, with government approval, certainly with condoms and bathrooms, you know, from the Surgeon General and seatbelts. But the fact of the matter is we have been able to make major inroads in how people view these three issues through public education. Same thing has to happen here. And we're starting that. That's starting to occur. And the release of the movie Fed Up on May 9th nationwide will hopefully be a major force in bringing that to the American public.
Well, we hope so, too. And I know that, Lori David is one of the producers of that. And she, of course, also made An Inconvenient Truth, the Academy Award-winning film that brought Al Gore's message to tremendously wider exposure. You seem to be speaking another inconvenient truth. And Dr. Lustig, I want to tell you I admire your courage and your clarity and your willingness to speak out on this topic. If the fate of our nation in some sense rests upon the weight of our nation, your message could hardly be more important. On behalf of myself and everyone involved with the Food Revolution Summit, I thank you for being with us today, and I thank you for the work that you're doing ongoingly.
Well, first of all, I appreciate your work and your interest, and I appreciate the fact that you also go up against the food industry. Bottom line, we all need to speak with one voice, because when we speak with one voice, it's music. Everything else is just noise. We have to band together. We, the populace of the United States, have to band together in order to fight this evil. And we will. It's just a question of time. We will get there. And we need everyone, all hands on board.
Dr. Martin Luther King said, "The arc of the moral universe is long, but I believe it bends towards justice." And perhaps indeed we are seeing that we can help bend that arc. We've been talking here with pediatric endocrinologist Robert Lustig, founder of the Institute for Responsible Nutrition and author of Fat Chance, Beating the Odds Against Sugar, Processed Food, Obesity, and Disease. Dr. Lustig, your research is thorough, and your findings are enormously significant. We want to thank you for your advocacy, for your work, for all the lives that you're touching with your important message. It's been an honor and a privilege to share this time with you, and we thank you for your partnership in the food revolution.
My pleasure. Thank you.
This concludes our interview, but our work is just getting started. If you feel excited by what you just heard and want to share it with other people in your life, if you want permanent access to 23 more amazing presentations and transcripts, then we have an offer to share. You can get a download and a transcript of the entire Food Revolution Summit, plus a huge collection of bonus resources. If you like, you can also get CDs, members-only courses, and a lot more. This empowerment package is available for a major discount between now and the end of the summit. For more information, please visit foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Again, that's foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Thanks so much for joining us in the Food Revolution. And now we have a pre-recorded message from one of the many people whose lives have been touched by the food revolution. This is the story of Eran Zahavi in his own words.
My name is Eran Zahavi. I'm 34 years old, and I'm an early partner in a startup technology company. I am very healthy and energetic. I love eating healthy food. My wife loves that about me and my diet and my choices, although that wasn't always the case up until a couple of years ago, I was pretty uninformed about the impact of my food choices and was eating a standard American diet. My wife was putting up with it, but it was a bit of a strain for us because I ate a lot worse than she did. And although I didn't know it at the time, it was actually a big strain for my body. So I discovered the Food Revolution Summit, and it couldn't have come at a more perfect time. I was about to become a dad. My company was growing pretty fast, and I would need more energy than I ever did. And lo and behold, I was able to find that through the change in my food choices. So with the Food Revolution Summit, I got a lot of the insights that I needed, and they came from trusted experts, which was great because I was able to get onto a healthier path. You know, now my wife and I are aligned with our food choices, and we're excited that we can raise our child in a healthy home, and we know what best to feed him as well as ourselves. And with my own personal choices, I found that my energy levels increased, my mental clarity increased, and that's been good for every aspect of my life, whether it's my business or my family or just my personal life. And the great benefit of the summit was that I could share what I learned with my friends and coworkers. And it wasn't just by me telling them what I learned, but with the empowerment package, I could lend them CDs, I could email them transcripts, or whatever they were looking for, I had a resource to point them in the right direction. Amazingly, really, the food revolution has not only been good for me, but it's been great for my family, it's been great for my professional life, it's great for my health, and it's been really amazing for the people around me, my friends and my colleagues. And I'm just really grateful to have this information at hand. Not only did I learn it, but I can continue to go back to it, and I can continue to share it. And most importantly, beyond changing my own habits, I have the opportunity to share it with the people that I love.
To share your feelings, thoughts, and reactions, and to hear from other Food Revolution Summit participants, you can post and engage in the comments section at the bottom of our broadcast page. You will need to refresh the page in order to see all the comments that have recently been posted. Our next presentation is going to be an interview with food politics author and New York University professor, Dr. Marion Nessel. It will start at the top of the hour, followed an hour after that by Dr. Michael Jacobson. Until then, here's some music from our friend, Bruce Bekvar. Thank you.